Bjorn, I will start with one thanks, and the thanks is to the organizers for getting me here, and one apology to all of you because I'll probably go over time. So one thing that I want to say is that this will be joint work that I'll be talking about with a number of good friends and collaborators, and whatever good you see in here should be attributed to them. Whatever bad you see in here should be blamed on me. And there is a number of references that have appeared now on this work, and I would be happy to give references to anyone that would be interested after the talk. But let's start from somewhere, and I want to give you a general outline of what I'll be talking about. So I'll be talking about BECs. Obviously, this talk is about BECs, so I have to tell you, first of all, at least roughly what BEC is about, and then I have to tell you something about the experimental wizardry that I think drives BEC these days, and I think I'll try to make the case that it will continue to drive BEC in the years to come. And then I will tell you something about what a poor nonlinear dynamicist such as myself might have to do with all that. And I'll try to convince you that there is something that we can say. And then I'm going to go and play a game. And the game that I'm going to go and play is I'm going to use my good old friends, the instabilities, but instead of the way Harvey was using them to destroy things, I will use them to generate things. So I will use the modulation instability in one dimension to generate solitons and soliton trains, and I will use the snaking instability in two dimensions to generate vortices and vortex lattices. And this will be a good excuse for me in order to study these kinds of patterns in one and two dimensions. So this is the game that I want to play in this kind of context. So let's start from somewhere, however, and the somewhere might as well be 1924, when Bose and Einstein predicted that if you have a quantum gas and if you go to sufficiently low temperature, then you have a quantum phase transition in which all the particles condense, or a macroscopic fraction of the particles condenses to the ground state. This is Bose-Einstein condensation, and it took about 70 years for three experimental wizards up there, who for that feat were awarded the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2001, to verify this in dilute alkali gases. And then in between, there was an amazing range of people doing an amazing related range of things, some of them including superconductivity and superfluidity, for which, by the way, the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2003 was awarded. And today, just to give you a general outline, there are about 35 experimental groups that can routinely produce BECs in front of your eyes, and there are about thousands of theoretical papers and hundreds of experimental papers in this blooming field. This is my one picture of a Bose-Einstein condensate coming from the experiment. This particular experiment comes from the Munich group, and so basically what I'm showing here is the wave function, and they can monitor the wave function both in position space and in momentum space these days. So there are a lot of amazing experimental techniques, and so this is the formation of a condensate wave function. And all this is very nice and interesting, but at the same time, it happens to be A, atomic physics, B, quantum mechanical, and C, ultra-low temperature. So what would we have to do with all that, or what would I, being a poor nonlinear dynamicist, would have to do with all that? And there is a kind of cute twist to answer that, and the cute twist is that if you write down the quantum mechanical wave function and you look at it, this has a kinetic energy term and it has a potential that I'll tell you a lot about, and then there is the interaction term between the different bosons, and it turns out that if you do a well-defined set of approximations, including that you are sufficiently cold, that you are sufficiently dilute, and so essentially that binary collisions is the only thing that happens, then you can approximate that interaction term with a delta function, and lo and behold, you get that quartic term that we kind of know and love in the energy, and if you take the derivative of that, the functional derivative of that, to get the relevant Schrödinger equation, of course you get the kinetic energy, and of course you get the external potentials, but you get the term that we kind of tend to like, or I tend to like, which is the nonlinear Schrödinger equation. So in principle, you end up with a 3D NLS in a certain potential, or in a set of different potentials. So since the twist here with respect to optics, at least, is the presence of the potentials, let me tell you something about these potentials. In principle, the potential will be a magnetic confinement of the atoms, and this magnetic confinement can be well approximated by a three-dimensional parabolic trap. This is the regular magnetic confinement. On top of that, experimental wizards can shine laser lights in counter-propagating directions and can form standing waves between these laser lights, and these standing waves can be well approximated by periodic potentials in all three directions, and these periodic potentials are called optical lattices. So what I'm basically telling you is that you can have a 3D magnetic trap and or a 3D optical lattice. Now, I'm a simple person. I don't like to deal with three-dimensional objects unless I really, really have to. And so the question that I ask myself, or that I ask colleagues, is can we have anything simpler than that? And the answer, interestingly enough, is that we can. So suppose that we play the following game. You confine very strongly your condensate along two directions, and along the third you let it weakly confine. Then you can make an approximate, an appropriate reduction in which in the two directions that you strongly confine, you essentially are in the ground state of the parabolic potential. And the third, this so-called cigar-shaped trap, along the third direction, you confine weakly, and then if you do the reduction to the appropriate one-dimensional equation along that third direction, lo and behold, comes out the one-dimensional nonlinear Schrödinger equation with a parabolic potential. So what I'm telling you, confine strongly two directions, then you end up with a 1D nonlinear Schrödinger equation with a parabolic potential. And you can imagine that you can play the same game with the optical lattice potential. So if you confine very strongly two directions, and in the third you have an optical lattice, you end up with a 1D periodic potential. And you can even imagine, and it is possible, you can confine not two directions, but you can confine very strongly one direction and leave the other two weakly confined in the so-called pancake-shaped trap. And then if in the other two, if you confine very strongly the one, and if in the other two you have a magnetic trap, then you can end up with a 2D magnetic trap. Or if in the other two you have an optical lattice, the so-called egg carton potential for obvious reasons, then you end up with a 2D optical lattice. So what I'm basically telling you is that you can engineer your context to be 1D magnetic trap or 1D optical lattice, 2D magnetic trap or 2D optical lattice, 3D magnetic trap and 3D optical lattice, or even you can engineer your context to be discrete equations. If you like discrete equations, and I do, you can make the thing discrete in the following case. If you have wells in this optical lattice which are sufficiently well separated, and the height of these barriers between them is sufficiently high, then you can make a reduction in the basis of eigenfunctions of the periodic potential that solid state physicists know very well, the one-year function basis. And then if you do the reduction appropriately in a very well-controlled way, you can end up deriving the discrete nonlinear Schrödinger equation, which basically measures the amplitude of the wave function in the bottom of the wells of these potentials. So basically what I've told you so far is I've laid out the setting of the game, and the setting of the game is 1D magnetic trap or 1D optical lattice, 2D magnetic trap or 2D optical lattice, 3D whatever, or even discrete whatever. So this is my setup for you. And now I'm going to go and play my game in this setup. So remember what my game was. My game is I'm going to go and use the instabilities in order to generate the solitons. And then once I generate the solitons, all sorts of solitons, I'll generate soliton trains and vortex lattices and vortex patterns and whatever, then I'm going to be motivated to go and study these solitons and to go and study these vortices. So this is my game. Play the instabilities, generate the patterns, use the patterns to study the solitons. Okay? All right, so let's start from somewhere, and the somewhere can as well be something that Harvey gave me a very good introduction for, the modulation instability in the case in which I have no trap whatsoever. Let's start with the simple stuff first. And Harvey analyzed that. Basically, you have a plane wave, and you make a small perturbation to that plane wave. You do simple linear stability analysis. You find that if you have sufficiently short wave numbers, or equivalently sufficiently long wavelengths of your perturbation, then you make this thing modulationally unstable. An equivalent way to see this, you can make a mode reduction. You can play the game not in the equation itself, but you can play the game in the Lagrangian, having these as dynamical variables, and then you can end up with a single equation either for B or for A. And what happens in the effective equation that you end up getting for this thing, as you cross the threshold for the instability, the well, the nature of the well that this thing sees, changes from minimum to maximum, so this thing becomes unstable, modulationally unstable, and so we are going to see the manifestations of this so-called Benjamin Fair instability. However, I'm just toying around for the moment, right? Because the real context, as I told you, is the context with the magnetic trap, or for that matter, with the optical lattice. So let's go and actually see what you can do with the magnetic trap. Turns out there's not much, unfortunately, that you can do, because you have explicit spatial dependence. And the game that both Harvey and I were playing was based on the fact that you have constant coefficients, and here you don't have them. You have the explicit spatial dependence. One thing that physicists knew a long time ago is that you can make a rescaling of your amplitude, a rescaling of your width, and a rescaling of time so that you can change the explicit spatial dependence and end up with a term lambda that encapsulates only a temporal dependence in the problem. And it turns out that if you choose your magnetic trap in such a way that you have kx squared but k dies out with time, like this, then this term lambda is a constant term and you end up exactly with the problem that Harvey was solving, and then you can solve the problem all the way to the end in the way that he was showing you. But unfortunately, this is not the most interesting case. The most interesting case is the case in which you really have a magnetic trap. And in that case, you kind of can go through with this thing, but then lambda becomes time dependent, so you still cannot do very much, and you have to resort to simulations. So let me tell you, first of all, in simulations, what would happen to the regular NLF without any potential. In the regular NLF, suppose that you go and excite a wave number which is modulationally stable. In this particular case, the threshold is at square root of 2. If you excite a wave number which is modulationally stable, nothing bad is going to happen. Everything is going to remain small perturbations. Everything will be very dull and uninteresting. However, go and excite a wave number, just as Harvey was telling you, which is modulationally unstable. You generate all the sidebands, and you generate very large amplitude structures. You generate exactly the solitons that we know and love. So you generate solitons by playing, by fiddling around with the modulation instability. So the interesting question is, what will happen to this modulation instability if you do it in the case in which you have the magnetic trap? So if you do that, and you excite a modulationally unstable wave number, you still will create growth. But there is a twist. And the twist is that you have this magnetic trap over here, and the magnetic trap tends to kill the wave function. It costs energy to go against the magnetic trap. So instead of having a whole array of solitons, you end up having a central soliton over there, and then smaller solitons and smaller solitons, and you die pretty fast. So this is the kind of pattern that you end up with in the numerical experiment. And the cute thing about it is that it qualitatively very well agrees with what is observed in an experiment. This is a snapshot of the Rice experiment, in which basically they have a modulation instability and they end up with a wave function that looks like a big spike, smaller spikes, and so on and so forth. So qualitatively, you can see that the kind of picture for soliton trains that you get from the theory is the same picture as what you get from the real experiment. And there is even another twist. And the other twist has to do with what would happen if I excited not a modulationally unstable wave number, but if I excited a modulationally stable wave number in this case. And if I excited a modulationally stable wave number, I would have small oscillations, but the magnetic trap does something bad. And the something bad that it does is it starts mixing wave numbers in momentum space. And if it mixes them, then it starts exciting some which are unstable. And so in that case, you will eventually end up having growth because you excite modulationally unstable wave numbers. But the growth will only happen at later timescales. So this is what basically will be happening if you excite modulationally unstable wave numbers, and this is what will be happening if you excite modulationally stable ones. So this is the case with the magnetic trap. Now, remember that my settings were 1D magnetic trap, 1D optical lattice, 2D magnetic trap, 2D optical lattice, you name it. And now, since I told you that we have the 1D optical lattice, let's go and do the thing in the 1D optical lattice. And because a number of people like the discrete equations, and I'm in that number of people, let me actually do it in the discrete equation. The discrete equation that you can derive is the discrete nonlinear Schrödinger equation. You can go through the whole machinery of the modulation instability. You get this mess, and if you look at the mess for a while, you realize that if in the system you excite a wave number which is larger than pi over 2, then you may become modulationally unstable. So the name of the game will become excite a wave number. Let me translate that into physics. Excite a quasi-momentum or a momentum. Remember, in quantum mechanics, momenta and wave numbers are inherently related. Excite a momentum which is larger than pi over 2, then you may be able to excite the modulation instability. So the question is, can you devise an experiment in which this will happen? And here is a clever, I think, indirect way in which you can do it. Suppose that you have a condensate in this magnetic trap. And suppose you move the magnetic trap a little bit. So here's your condensate, here's your magnetic trap. Let me actually draw it. Here's your magnetic trap, and here's your condensate. Suppose that you now move your magnetic trap a little bit. If you move your magnetic trap a little bit, the condensate will try to do oscillations around the new center of the magnetic trap. Right? So it will start acquiring some momentum because it starts going back and forth. So it acquires a large momentum when it passes through here. But if your displacement is sufficiently small, this momentum is still quite small. If, on the other hand, you go and make the displacement pretty large, then the momentum that this guy acquires becomes large. And then it may become larger than pi over 2. And if it becomes larger than pi over 2, then you're going to hit the instability. So this is the kind of trick that you can play, and you can play it in the experiment, and let's see how it goes. First of all, let's play it in some sort of theory. Let's define the center of mass, and let's define something like that momentum that I was telling you about, and then you can derive collective coordinate equations for the mass, center of mass, and for the momentum, and then from these you can find that if you make the displacement sufficiently large, from energy considerations, you can find when this momentum will become larger than pi over 2, you can find for what displacement, for how large displacements from simple energy considerations, the quasi-momentum will become larger than pi over 2. And remember this equation, it basically says that the critical displacement is proportional to the coupling between adjacent sites, k is the coupling between adjacent sites, and omega is the frequency of the magnetic trap. So if I make the displacement larger than this, I'm going to hit pi over 2, I'm going to become modulationally unstable, I'm going to see something. And let me also define an order parameter that will be helpful in my probing the instability. So let's do the actual numerical experiment first, and then let's do the actual real experiment afterwards. If I do a displacement which is sufficiently small, everything is dull. Just as you expect, there will be just oscillations, both in the discrete equation, which is the envelope of the continuum equation, and in the actual continuum equation. You just have coherent, as we call them, superfluid oscillations. If, on the other hand, you go and make the displacement sufficiently large, then the thing tries to oscillate, but then it hits pi over 2. It becomes modulationally unstable, and the result of this is the hitting of the instability. And, of course, you may not believe me. You may not believe that this is indeed a good criterion or that the theory is correct. So in this particular case, in dimensional units, the theory predicts that the instability, say, would happen at 85 micrometers of a displacement. So suppose that you make a displacement of 40 micrometers. Then the thing just oscillates in a very nice and coherent and dull way. Suppose that you make the displacement 80 micrometers. Then the thing still oscillates in a very nice and coherent and dull way. Suppose that you go and hit 90, then the wave function quasi-momentum, the momentum becomes larger than pi over 2. You hit the instability, you hit the threshold, and you lose your coherence. You become what we call an insulator. You lose the phase coherence of the condensate. So you hit the instability. And if you still don't believe me, let me show you this order parameter over here. So for this order parameter, basically, for 40 micrometers, you have perfect coherence. Everything is orderly. For 80 micrometers, you have perfect coherence. Everything is orderly. Go and hit 90. Go and become larger than pi over 2, and you hit the instability. And in the end of the day, the one thing that kind of makes you and breaks or breaks you, and this is the one thing that I kind of want to advocate for this field, and the one thing that I kind of want you to take out of this, is that in this kind of new context of BEC, you can really make explicit predictions. And the explicit predictions that you can make can be very well, very accurately, very precisely measured in the experiment. So here's an experiment in the Florence group, which is now published, in which basically they measure the critical displacement as a function of V naught, and V naught is something like 1 over k. Remember, my prediction was xi was proportional to the square root of k. So this is something like proportional to square root of 1 over V naught. And the explicit theoretical curve is given by the solid line here. In all the cases in which they did experiments for which they found that there was perfect coherence, no instability, everything was nice, are shown over there by filled circles. Every case for which they did experiments in which they found loss of coherence, they found instability, they found something nasty happening, are shown by open circles. And you can see how these two compare with the explicit prediction of the theory. So this is the one thing that I kind of want to advocate for this field, is that you can make explicit theoretical predictions and you can test this very cleanly and very precisely in the experiment. And since we got to that point, remember what my story was. My story was you can do 1D magnetic trap or 1D optical lattice. You can do 2D magnetic trap or 2D optical lattice. You can do 3D magnetic trap or 3D optical lattice, and you can even do discrete stuff. And I told you something about instability in 1D magnetic trap, and I told you something about instability in 1D optical lattice. Now let's go and do 2D. If you go and do 2D, and suppose that you have a radial trap, then the condensate is something like this, but it's something like this radially in the trap. So if I am to show you a picture, then the thing will look as something like this. Ignore this little dip. Zero is black. The condensate is white inside the black which is basically the position where the magnetic trap becomes strong. So this is the picture of the condensate. This is the cut of the condensate. And because, remember, I want to create instabilities, let me go and play this game in which I write this radial dip in the condensate, this radial dip, which is something which was known before in optics and is called a ring dark soliton. So let me write in that condensate, which is something experimentally feasible, by the way, let me write a radial soliton in that condensate. And if I do that, and if I look at what the dynamics of this soliton in that context is going to be, then I find equations from soliton perturbation theory for the position of the center of the soliton and for the amplitude of this soliton. And if I combine these two equations, I find this kind of equation, which I like quite a bit. And the reason why I like it is the following. In 1D BECs, the only thing that existed was the potential. And so the right equation was the one that I'm showing. In 2D optics, the ring solitons existed, but the potential did not exist. So the only thing that existed was this term from curvature, and this was known from before. Now, in 2D BEC, you have both of these, and the cute thing about them is that the potential is attractive at long ranges, and the curvature is repelling at short ranges, so you end up having a potential which is like this, and so has a minimum, and that minimum would be a ring dark soliton, which would be stationary. Furthermore, if I have any ring radius which is larger than this, then the radius is just going to oscillate between a minimum and the maximum value that you can find explicitly. And now let's see how the experiment, the numerical experiment in this case, verifies this. Suppose that you start from something that has a radius larger than the critical, then we have found that this thing constricts up to, down to the minimum and expands up to the maximum and constricts and expands and keeps on doing exactly what the theory predicts it should be doing. But this is not the cute part. The cute part is what happens if you go and make this little dip sufficiently deep. Then the thing starts to become unstable towards the azimuthal modulations. It becomes even more unstable. It starts snaking. And can you see what is coming? Well, what is coming is exactly the natural patterns for two-dimensional context is vortices. So you end up having vortices and vortex pairs, and in fact, vortex pairs that alternate between crosses and X's, and from they alternate between these two kinds of configurations. And in fact, there are interesting pattern selection phenomena, because even though you may start from 8, 16, 24, or 32 vortices, you always end up with 8. And that would be, I think, an interesting problem for people interested in coarsening. So remember my story. My story was create the modulation instability in one dimension to get the soliton trains, create the snaking instability to get the vortices and the vortex lattices. And now that I have both the soliton trains and the vortex patterns, I'm going to go and actually study the patterns. And the most fundamental pattern, and this is again, amazingly enough, an experiment, the most fundamental pattern for attractive interactions is a bright soliton, is a regular bright soliton pulse. And this has been found in an experiment. You see that if the thing is not a soliton, it disperses out very nicely. But if it is a soliton, it very robustly propagates over distances of the order of millimeter, over times of the order of millisecond, without anything happening to it. So this is what a bright soliton seems like in the experiment. And since the experimentalists are so good that they can create single solitons, let's make their life a little bit more interesting. Let's make them do multiple solitons. So two solitons, three solitons, and so on and so forth. So you can have multi-solitons, and you can find what their interaction looks like. You can find how they interact with the substrate potential, be it a harmonic potential or be it a parabolic potential. You can find what kind of landscape they feel. And from that, you can predict when you will have multiple solitons that will be present. And you can have these multi-solitons, so this is an up-down soliton with the sinusoidal potential. You can have this with the magnetic trap and the sinusoidal potential, or you can have this with the magnetic trap alone. And furthermore, if you look at the spectrum of these things, you find interesting oscillatory instabilities that have very interesting dynamical manifestations, such as the following. So if you start with something which is unstable due to oscillatory instability, here is the initial condition, then the thing becomes unstable in an oscillatory fashion and then eventually gets destroyed. So there is exactly the kind of phenomena that you would expect would happen. And not only can you have two solitons, you can have three solitons, and you can have them in the periodic potential, in the magnetic trap plus periodic potential, or in the magnetic trap alone. So you can create A, multi-solitons. You can create B, breathing solitons, because it turns out, I mean, if you know enough about optics, you will know that there is this very nice scheme that allows you to create very robust solitons. This is called dispersion management, and in this scheme you alternate between a positive, negative, positive, negative, positive, negative, and so on, dispersion. You can do the same thing here, but not with the dispersion, it turns out. Remember, always in this context, this will come with a twist. You can do it with the nonlinearity. You can alternate, it turns out, the nonlinearity between positive, negative, positive, negative, positive, negative. And as you may expect, when you do that, first of all, you have interesting stability conditions, because you end up with equations that have Arnold tongs and all sorts of interesting stability features. But more interestingly, you end up with breathing matter waves. This is a soliton. This is space. This is time, which breathes in and out. It breathes in and out. Time goes on, and I keep on breathing. So this is a bright soliton which is breathing, because the interactions are changing from positive to negative. So this guy wants to change shape as you change from positive to negative. And by the way, this is a dark soliton that is also breathing like this as time goes on. So you can create breathing solitons. You can even create multi-component solitons. I told you about multi-pulse solitons. I told you about breathing solitons. Now you can have multi-component solitons, in which, for example, up there I'm showing one component being a bright soliton and the other being what we call an anti-dark soliton. It can also be possible for one to be bright and the other to be gray, or for the one to be dark and the other to be anti-dark, for the one to be dark and the other to be gray, and so on and so forth. You can create all sorts of new beasts that did not exist at all in the optical context. And now these can exist, and furthermore, they will persist in the presence of both the magnetic trap and the optical lattice. So all sorts of new things. And if your favorite thing are vortices, there are even interesting things about the vortices. So here is a case in which you have a vortex in a magnetic trap and an optical lattice, and the vortex has very interesting unstable dynamics, in which it starts spiraling out towards the boundary and keeps on going, because it is unstable in the presence of the optical lattice. So there are very interesting dynamics of the vortices. And let me remind you what my game was, because I'm going to go and undo my game. My game was create the instabilities to generate the solitons and then study the solitons. But suppose that you want to avoid the instabilities and to avoid destroying things because of the instabilities. Remember that the instabilities that I told you about are instabilities at long wavelengths. So you have to be beyond the critical wavelength to generate the instability. So if you confine your condensate sufficiently strongly that the wavelength of the instability does not appear, so that you have wavelengths which are shorter than the critical wavelength for the instability, then you can avoid having the instabilities in the first place. And that gives you criteria for which the instabilities will never manifest themselves. And let me give you an example. This is a dipole pattern which can be very stable if you take care to avoid the instability. If, on the other hand, you don't take care to avoid the instability, instead of a dipole, you end up having what I call a monkey pole. So you end up having an instability for which the vortices that get created are the eyes of this monkey. So you end up seeing the instability because you didn't take enough care in this case. And you can have interesting average dynamics and all sorts of other things. But let me tell you one of the last things that I kind of like and that we have done very recently, and this is vortex lattices. And so if you start with random, these are individual vortices that are started at random positions in space, and you let them go in some sort of special molecular dynamics that we have devised for this scheme. And if you do that, then you end up with vortices that are perfectly in a triangular configuration, which is exactly the ground state, by the way, of this vortex lattice kind of system. And by the way, by means of pattern formation, there are all sorts of interesting transient patterns, such as rhomboidal vortex lattices or star-like vortex lattices, you name it. There are all sorts of interesting dynamical phenomena. Having said all that, let me go back and tell you what my game was. My game was, and the message that you should take with you, is that you can do all sorts of interesting settings in this BEC stuff. You can do 1D magnetic trap or 1D optical lattice, 2D magnetic trap or 2D optical lattice. You can do 3D magnetic trap, 3D optical lattice, or even discrete systems. You can play the game of the instabilities. Remember, the modulation instability gave me these smaller spikes, smaller spikes, smaller spikes, gave me soliton trains. You can play the snaking instability, and that will give you vortices. And then you can take care so that you can even avoid the instabilities if you don't want them. So you can do all sorts of things, and there are even more things that we don't know how to do. And by the way, remember, there are all sorts of different solitons. There are single solitons, multiple solitons, multi-component solitons, breathing solitons, two-dimensional solitons, higher dimensional solitons, you name it. There are all sorts of interesting dynamics and all sorts of interesting phenomena. And many of them, such as the vortex lattices, the higher dimensional breathing solitons, the multi-component solitons, genuinely discrete solitons, we don't understand sufficiently well, and I would be delighted to get any help that I can get on these things. And furthermore, there are interesting issues about collapse, which is a very interesting problem in higher dimensions. And all of what I've done, by the way, is for the condensate. I didn't tell you anything about the thermal cloud that is coupled to this condensate. So there are interesting PDEs that can be written for the coupling of the thermal cloud with the condensate, which is what I have been describing to you so far. And if you have any interest in any of these things, I would be delighted to talk to you about them. Thank you very much for bearing with me all this time. Thank you.